Hey everyone, welcome to another Your Amigos podcast. Tom and I are joined by Alison Birtle from Rosemere Cancer Center in the UK. I think this is a paper of the month, which we do not every month, but it's an especially high honor, Alison. Thank you for being here.
But
I'm going to turn it over to you.
Does take the edge off it when you say, I think it's paper of the month. Is there uncertainty about whether Alison...
It wasn't about the paper. It was about the monthly award.
Oh, you definitely
right,
won.
Let me start over, Tom.
No, this is good. I like this.
Tom criticizing my intros. This is a new low for
you
me.
You definitely won, but we don't know which month.
Okay, that's absolutely fine. You could have it as sort of the quarter if you like. I'm quite comfortable with that.
Oh, we'd be more than happy to give you that award as well.
All right.
Well, I feel my job here is done. Thank you so much.
Very nice speaking to you. Goodbye.
All right, let's start over. Hey everyone, welcome to Your Amigos Paper of the Month. We are here, Tom and I are here with Alison Birtle from the Rosemere Cancer Center in the UK, and Alison is the first author of a recent update of the POUT trial. As many of you know, this was an open label trial in resected upper tract urothelial cancer randomized into chemo or surveillance that previously showed a DFS benefit, and there was some updated data and updated OS just published in JCO. So Alison, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Maybe just briefly introduce yourself, and then maybe you could start out with sort of what we knew heading into this publication.
Oh, thanks so much for having me this evening. So I'm a clinical oncologist based in the sunny northwest of England. And the POUT study was originally presented at ASCO GU. It seems like a lifetime ago, but it was only back in 2018. And the study had originally tried to answer the question, which we never attempted before, which was, does giving chemotherapy adjuvantly, platinum-based, after nephroureterectomy for upper tract urothelial carcinoma improve outcomes? And everybody said, look, it's a rare cancer. You won't be able to do a study in that population. And we did. And of course, Tom is a co-author of the publications as well. And we first presented the data, as I say, back in 2018. And at that point, we had 2 and 3 year disease-free survival and metastasis-free survival. And those were at that point 19 and 21% respectively. And just to set some context, because it's a rare incident tumor, we chose disease-free survival as the primary endpoint because you'd need a massive study to have an overall survival for an adjuvant study in a rare tumor site. Mm-hmm. So we chose DFS pragmatically and 3 years as a point of interest because patients, particularly with the T3, T4 tumors, seem to relapse within that time. So it's a very pragmatic study. It was 4 cycles of adjuvant chemotherapy, either gemcitabine, cisplatin, or gemcitabine carboplatin, initiated within 90 days of surgery. And the patients had to have completely resected T2 to T4, N0 to N3 upper tract urothelial carcinoma. Now, we didn't mandate a lymph node dissection because it wasn't standard of care at the time. And we did a survey across the UK looking at what standard of care was and what people would be prepared to do. And so as long as they'd had any macroscopically visible nodes resected at the time of surgery, and they then went on to have a negative pre-treatment CT scan, then they were eligible to go into the study. And the only reason to get carboplatin with gemcitabine was based on reasons of GFR alone. So it was stratified based on a GFR of between 30 and 49. You then got gem carbo. And if it was greater than 50 or greater, you got gem cis, because we didn't really want to get into all the confounding variables of poorer performance status and other reasons for cisplatin ineligibility.
So that wasn't MD discretion. It was prescribed in the protocol,
it was mandated in the protocol. So we did have queries from sites about it, and in fact I had to stand by my protocol because there was one of my patients who, under normal circumstances, he was obese, he'd had some cardiac events in the past, his ejection fraction was probably about 50. And you know when you just get an inclination of whether somebody you think would be cisplatin or carbo, and if he'd been metastatic, I would probably have given him carboplatin. But his GFR was about 90. So I had to stand by my protocol and either offer him the study or not.
There's a song in that. Alison, about 20% got gem carbo, about 80% gem cis. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. There was. Well, I think it was actually more. I think it was more 70-30, really. Okay. So, yeah. So,
and what were the hazard ratios for DFS and OS in your original? I think it was in the Lancet, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it was about 4.5 with a 19% difference at 3 years and 21% for metastasis-free survival. And we had a trend towards overall survival, but because we met the primary endpoint early, which was disease-free survival. And you and I know, Tom, we had long discussions about whether we could keep the study open because we really would have loved to have recruited to the full numbers for the study, which was about 346 patients. But the...
Brian?
Yeah, I'm here.
Alison's disappeared. I was just going to say, she's going to say, actually, the Independent Data and Monitoring Committee came forward and they said to us, you know, we need to stop the trial because it's unethical to randomize patients into this in the knowledge that it's a positive study. I actually felt quite strongly at the time that we should keep going because OS is so important in this setting.
Mm-hmm. So it's about 2/3 accrued then.
We wanted the magic number of about 346 patients, and we got to 261. And with this, you know, it was probably our one chance to get this information. And there was we didn't take the decision lightly, and there was mixed opinions when we made the decision. But that's life, isn't it?
It was me versus everyone else, I think.
Well, I have to say, Tom, you know, you're quite right in saying, look, this is our one chance to get the information. But it's, you know, when you're faced with sort of effectively ethical dilemmas, we had to sort of, you know, you have IDMCs and trial steering committees for a reason. And it would have been tricky to have gone against their decision, I think. So, but, you know, and we can't turn the clock back. We still got a study that was strongly positive for DFS and MFS at the time. And the long-term 5-year final outcome data sort of actually strengthens that as well.
Alison, before we get there,
yeah.
Why didn't we do a neoadjuvant trial? Would that not have been easier?
Oh, so nobody realises the amount of work that went into developing this study. So this was a back of a postcard idea, looking at what should we do for UTUC? Because every time we were at an MDT, the surgeons would say what the pathology was and what do you want to do? And we'd say, well, there's no evidence to give adjuvant chemotherapy. And so we had a discussion about whether it should be neoadjuvant or adjuvant. And as oncologists, we're fairly simple souls. We like to have something with a bit of paper in our hand that says this is definitely cancer. And we know that UTUC is a difficult, you know, to access definite histology just because of where it sits. And we know that even in the best of hands, you are going to not have 100% certainty that you're dealing with an invasive malignancy. And the pathology, you know, the patients who've got PT1 tumours, their prognosis is so much better. It drops as soon as you get to a T2. So we thought, well, let's ask the question, and let's ask the question of people that will recruit to the study. Let's ask the question of patients. So we did a questionnaire across the whole of the UK to ask, what is your current practice? Would you be happy putting patients into a study? Would you prefer a neoadjuvant or an adjuvant study? And we asked urologists and oncologists. And we also convened two patient focus groups and had a couple of days with them and went through the study and said, look, these are your options. And actually, it was the patients and the clinicians who said they wanted to do an adjuvant study. And that's why we did an adjuvant study, because particularly in a low risk, in a low incidence tumour, if you don't get that study design to be one that the patients and the clinicians want, you know, it doesn't matter how clever we think it is in our head, that study's never going to recruit.
Alison, there are a couple of JCO publications out of the US, and Brian can talk in more detail about this, but there are lots of people in the US who feel we should be giving neoadjuvant chemotherapy. The two phase two studies in JCO look pretty good. The outcome data looks really good. And because you've still got that second kidney there doing the work, there are more patients that can get cisplatin-based therapy. What do you say to those American colleagues?
I'll say what I always say to them is that what we've seen with particularly the updated paper is that carboplatin and cisplatin look the same. And we can, in the real world, we give
cisplatin down to GFRs of 50 and sometimes down to 45 if we fractionate the cisplatin. And we can give carboplatin down to a GFR of 30. And yes, the GFR does drop a bit, but we can still give, you know, treatment to most of those patients. And do you really want to over-treat a patient who actually subsequently turns out to have a PT1 tumor, nephroureterectomy? And we know from the screening logs in POUT that there were some people who we'd have said beforehand this was a T2 tumor and their pathology came back as T1, and that's without any treatment. And vice versa, there were some unexpected PT1 tumors that turned out to be PT2 on pathology. And so if even in the best of hands, the sensitivity and specificity of knowing that it's a, you know, an invasive tumor is still only about 75%. And I'm not talking about those where we've got humongous inoperable tumors, because there's always a mix up with these phase two neoadjuvant in inverted commas studies about how much is neoadjuvant and how much is actually downstaging chemotherapy. And of course, there's a difference between those two aspects. And of course, the primary endpoint of all these studies was PCR rates. And we know you're going to get downstaging because that's what this type of chemotherapy does in urothelial cancer. So we know that it works. So I think there's still a lot of caveats about neoadjuvant treatment. And the other thing is, we know from admittedly historical studies like ODMIT-C, and also there's a York study from Chital et al., which is looking at patients who were thought to have upper tract urothelial cancer. And then you look at their pathology afterwards, and they found this in ODMIT-C. 13%, I think, didn't either have cancer or didn't have the right type of cancer. So yes, we've got a bit better than that, but we can't exclude those patients that we're going to treat in error.
Let me add a couple of things. I mean, Allison, one is you seem to have done a tremendous amount of homework before designing the study, to your point being able to accrue a rare study. So kudos. And as you say, it's sort of the only study. And to your point, I don't think you would have been able to accomplish it without that homework. And I think that's probably a lesson for doing, you know, trials in rare tumors. And then, Tom, in terms of the practice in the U.S., I don't know, actually. I'm not sure I can speak broadly to it. I mean, personally and institutionally, we don't tend to give neoadjuvant therapy to upper tract unless it's, you know, some clinically big bulky nodes or, you know, some sort of obvious beyond T1 tumor. But I honestly don't know. I'm not sure I've seen data. I think now with the POUT data, most people tend to wait till adjuvant.
We did a podcast on it back in the day, Brian, and I think that there is some of the phase two data comes out. Phase two data often comes out very encouraging, but some of the phase two neoadjuvant data comes out really nicely. Alison, we've kind of put the cart before the horse a little bit in that, having won the paper of the month, we've not given you the opportunity to describe your paper yet,
which I apologize.
Alison, would you like to talk about your recent JCO paper, a paper that won paper of the month for the Euromigos podcast?
Oh, darling, I'd be delighted to do that. So my paper of the month is my first author paper, but alongside so many people far better than I, from the Institute of Cancer Research, the trials team, many urologists and oncologists across the UK, and most importantly, our two patient members on the group, who I just want to spend a moment mentioning. So Chris Harris was part of our original focus group, and our original focus group was back in around 2010. And then Andrew Winterbottom, who was the second member of the trial management group, who also was the founder of the patient advocacy group Fight Bladder Cancer. And I think, you know, they helped to shape and deliver the trial probably in the best way possible. And of course, Brian, thank you for mentioning the all the work we've done. We also did a qualitative sub-study with POUT so that we could give top tip, and that was recording consultations and then giving feedback both to oncologists, urologists, specialist nurses, so we could look at barriers to recruitment from the use of the language that we have. And that's really important with an adjuvant study, because if you say to a patient, you've had a lovely operation and it's all sitting, you know, I've removed it all, you immediately close the door on a discussion about adjuvant treatment. So it's about use of language and barriers. And that, I think that's a really key thing if you're going to do a rare incidence tumor trial, or a trial where you've got very different endpoints where people might lack clinical equipoise. But when we go to the paper of the month, the JCO paper, what we've done is we've reported the final outcomes with this. And this has just strengthened the original paper. So we've got 5-year follow-ups, and at 5 years, the disease-free survival was 62% versus 45%. evidence in favour of chemotherapy with an HR of 0.55. So the data is now very mature. The overall survival data is more mature, and it's still a strong trend between the strong trend in favour of chemotherapy. There were no other adverse events that we were worried about, because, of course, this is chemotherapy we give day in, day out. When we look on univariate analysis, then the OS benefit is statistically significant. And when we look at multivariate, then it isn't. It still has the strong trend. But interestingly, what we did was we modelled it to look over a 9-year period using this this different statistical technique. The clearest benefit looks between 3 and 4 years. And I guess that sort of fits with when we see these patients relapse, doesn't it? The carboplatin data was strengthened as well. I think the other thing that it's important to mention is when we look at second treatments for these patients, this was at a time when we didn't have very many effective second line treatments. So a lot of the patients who were in the treatment arm wouldn't have got second line treatment. Other interesting thing is we've reported for the first time bladder cancer relapse. And there was no difference between the chemotherapy arm and the surveillance arm. And that's probably because the upper tract and lower tract tumours are different beasts. And that's why we see all of the other studies. So with the checkpoint inhibitors that we might expect to be positive, they've all been negative so far in UTUC.
So Alison Lotze, I wanted to ask about that carboplatin subset, which, yeah, as we said, was about 30 or 40%. So am I remembering correctly, in the original publication, it looked like there was a difference between cis and carbo and cis favored
cis? Depends how you interpret it. So, okay.
There's at least a difference in hazard ratios, yeah, notwithstanding small was, numbers, yeah, and all those, yeah, normal caveats, yeah, but it seems to have evened out, and both of those hazard ratios are almost identical in the 0.5 range. Was that just the noise of early analysis and small numbers, or something else?
I think so. And the other thing was that the confidence intervals were always going to be that bit wider because it was smaller numbers. And the same with the formal node positive group, because remember that we didn't mandate a lymph node dissection. We didn't mandate a template dissection. So the numbers that were node positive on pathology were always going to be small.
Mm-hmm. So is there any reason to then give cis in the setting if carbo does just as well?
That's a really interesting point. And of course, there's been an updated publication looking at the utility of carboplatin and cisplatin that I was sort of co-author on with Rick Bryan about a year or two ago. And I think we can now use the carboplatin data to say if we would prefer to give that to the patient, then why not? I think the EAU guidelines are still in favour of cisplatin. We may review that next year. We just republished the EAU guidelines, which we had to completely rewrite for upper tract, given the EV-302 data. So thanks very much, Tom, for that. That's a weekend of my life I'll never get back.
Thanks for shout out. I'm grateful.
Tom, do you agree with that in this setting, given the hazard ratios look the same for these subsets, that you would just give gem carbo in the setting to everyone, or no?
I think there are two ways of looking at this. I think the first way to look at it is an ITT trial. We're good to go, and the subsets look about the same. I think the second way of looking at it is that in the adjuvant and the neoadjuvant setting, carboplatin, which has been more robustly treated in bladder cancer, has been outperformed by cisplatin. And under those circumstances, in this underpowered trial that's come in, this new data needs to be put in the context of the wider data where people believe cisplatin is superior to carboplatin. And under those circumstances, this is not enough evidence on its own to say cisplatin and carboplatin are interchangeable. One of the difficulties about this is if you take this argument to its extreme, you could say you could include any population or small population in a trial, and providing the good population is strong and has a good hazard ratio, you can dilute that signal. And so an example, for example, would be clear cell and papillary renal cancer. You could include a whole lot of, or some papillary cancer patients in the clear cell cohort give ipi-nivo, the trial would still be positive because the ipi-nivo is being carried over the line by the clear cells. The papillaries are passengers.
Subset wouldn't look the same, right? The forest plot wouldn't.
Well, the forest plot analysis is complicated, isn't it? Because you can look at it, you can look at it as a sort of non-inferiority or superiority. So the problem with any forest plot analysis is you've only got 30% of 200 patients, it's 70 patients, and you wouldn't want to change the whole of bladder cancer based off 70 patients.
No, I get it. It was 100 patients, but I get what you're saying. But so you would still give CIS to patients with GFR 50 and above.
Absolutely. And I'm not convinced I would give carboplatin to the cisplatin ineligible patients. And the reason I wouldn't do that is because the ESMO guidelines committee met about this and we couldn't come to a consensus. And I'm sort of involved in that group. And there are some people who feel very strongly that carboplatin is not a perioperative driver in bladder cancer. And we shouldn't be adopting it based off this subset in the POUT trial.
It's interesting, though. I think it's interesting because, you know, we reflect on, you know, extrapolating things from bladder cancer, but we know they, you know, these tumours behave differently. They've got different prognosis. We know that they've got different rates of microsatellite instability and hypermethylation. So I always think they're a bit more like non-identical twins rather than identical twins. So just because we see a signal for something in bladder cancer doesn't mean that it's necessarily translatable to UTUC. And I think that was one of the surprises with me when we, as I say before, when we were looking at sort of the role of checkpoint inhibitors in this setting for UTUC patients, it appears very different to what we might have expected and very different to what we see in the checkpoint inhibitor adjuvant trials.
This is one of the questions which I, in urothelial cancer, the adjuvant upper tract urothelial patients, this is one of the questions which I struggle with the most, and I don't know the right answer. I can, and you would be reasonable to say to me, Tom, let's assume adjuvant Nevo is not there. We'll talk about that in a second. You would be very reasonable to say to me, Tom, wait a second. You're not giving these patients therapy. You know those relapsed patients go really wrong. Many patients don't get second line therapy, and you're denying them treatment, which we've done a trial for, which actually they look pretty good. The question, I guess, which comes out next is, there was no survival advantage. We didn't get that survival advantage. That was the original problem with adjuvant carbo and neoadjuvant carbo, is we got OS in randomized phase threes for adjuvant and neoadjuvant cisplatin. We never got it with carbo because we never hit OS in this study. If we want to hold ourselves to the same standards across urothelial cancer without OS, it means it doesn't really cross that threshold. And that means ultimately it's not as strong as those other trials. How do you come back to that, Alison?
Well, I think we've got a strong trend, haven't we? And things have been done on strong trends before now, and it's positive on univariate, but not on multivariate analysis. So I really strongly believe when we've looked at the on the univariate analysis, and you can see that there's a benefit of 11 months over that 9-year period, peaking in those early years when we know the patients are going to relapse. It's intuitive to think this is going to translate into a survival benefit. And to, you know, if we wait till people relapse, then some of those patients are never going to make it onto any other form of treatment. So yes, it's my study. I'm always going to be conflicted, but I have to say, this is what I would want one of my family members to have. I would treat you with this regime, Tom, if you came to me.
Heaven forbid. Well, I'd love you to treat me. You'd be a fabulous oncologist, but I hope our paths don't cross in that respect.
And it looks like about 60% of the surveillance patients got systemic therapy upon recurrence. So I think to both your earlier points, and I know there's complications in a trial that we've talked about many times in this podcast, but it's certainly not everybody that's able to get systemic therapy upon recurrence.
No, and sometimes, you know, we know that we generally miss the boat in these patients, particularly the T3, T4 tumors. What we weren't telling the patients originally when we, you know, they have their nephroureterectomy was that, you know, you've got a risk, quite a significant risk of relapse within the next 2 to 3 years. And I think that bit of information giving was what we learned when we did the qualitative sub-study, that patients were just being told, that's it, you know, your kidney and your ureter are out and you'll never need any more treatments. And that's not the way that other tumours work. So, you know, when you have any other Any other surgical resection, you're normally told to wait for the pathology of your colorectal resection or your breast resection just to see what other treatment that you'd need. But we haven't really, you know, we weren't doing that at all in UTUC. And I find one of the most fascinating things at the moment with my bladder cancer hat on is obviously we've just had some up-to-date stuff from Tom from Invigor 011. And I'm firmly convinced of the role in bladder cancer of CTCs in terms of looking at sort of as guiding adjuvant treatment. I think that's a story that's really evolving.
Alison, the next big question is in the same session at EAU, Matt Galski gave a presentation and he showed the adjuvant Nevo data. Again, it's not statistically significant survival. It's a survival, it's an updated survival signal or a recent survival signal. The numbers looked at trending in the right direction in the same way as POUT was, but not statistically significant. Did look more impressive, in my opinion, in the PD-L1 positive population. Again, there are lots of complicated issues. We didn't see the PD-L1 negative data. A modest proportion of patients didn't get subsequent therapy. The survival is not statistically significant. And there has been controversy in the upper tract cohort because both in the Invigor 010 trial, but also in this study, it didn't seem to benefit those upper tract patients. But the updated OS signal, in the same way as your carboplatin population in the original cohort, you know, was showed some uncertainty, but then came back to showing similarities across the two populations. In the upper tract cohort, in that survival signal, not statistically significant, the ITT population, so obviously these subsets aren't statistically significant either, but they're both trending in the right direction, which begins to swim against that sort of tide saying immune therapy doesn't work in upper tract patients. What did you make of the 274 adjuvant data set, and which patients are you giving adjuvant GemCis, GemCarbo to, and which patients are you giving adjuvant Nevo to?
So I was in that same session and it was really interesting because my takeaway message is very different to a very eminent uro-oncologist, not yourselves, but equally eminent that I was sat next to, because it was a really well-crafted presentation. It never mentioned the words clinically significant, and it never said statistically significant. But my colleague next to me said, oh, well, you know, who would have thought that there's a definite OS benefit with adjuvant Nevo? I wasn't expecting that. And I said, well, they didn't say it was statistically significant. They just said there was more of a trend, and these were the latest results, because presumably they've got some people on treatments who are doing very well and they want to carry on following them up. But they know that in the wider community, we were all asking, why have we still not seen any, you know, updated OS data and the actual, you know, updated publication. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I'm not sure we're looking at the same survival plots in terms of the subgroup analyses. And yes, there were fewer UTUC patients. Some of these studies had got a maximum number of 10 or 20% of patients of the whole population being UTUC and the rest being post-cystectomy. But the upper tract patients, the renal pelvis is crossing fairly substantially across UNITY, and the ureters the other side. Now, they're small numbers, but they're not coming back to the same level as the bladder. And it is a slightly different population because some of these patients could have had neoadjuvant chemotherapy. I haven't seen, then you'll end up with a subgroup of a subgroup. Yep. So it's a slightly different population. So I think there are two separate things going on here. One is, what's the signal overall? And secondly, what about the UTUC? And, you know, we can't be sort of breaking down UTUC into those who've had neoadjuvant treatment, those who were probably, you know, it's probably downstaging if they've still been ended up with unfavorable pathology, so it wasn't neoadjuvant, and who were PD-L1 positive. So in terms of UTUC, we've got data to show that adjuvant chemotherapy improves DFS in this group, and that's what they should be getting.
Alison, is there anyone getting Nevo, or is everyone getting, so you've got PD-L1 positive patients, they've had surgery, they haven't had neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and they come and see you in front of you, they're both in the UK, PD-L1 positive, And let's say they're PD-L1 positive, they've got two options. They've got Nevo, or they've got four cycles of gem cis. Let's say they've got creatinine clearance of 65. What are you giving them?
The creatinine clearance needs to be 50 to give them gem cis.
65, they can have gem cis.
Yeah. So I give them gem cis, and the EAU guidelines say that the strong recommendation is for adjuvant chemotherapy. And it should only be Nevo for those patients who are PD-L1 positive and who refuse chemotherapy or are unsuitable for chemotherapy. And it's the weak recommendation. So conflict of interest, I sit on the UTUC guidelines group, but that's the current recommendation. And that's what I do in the clinic.
Tom, let me ask you the same question.
Do ask him.
GFR 65, or let's say 45, take those two different patients.
Yeah.
Strongly PD-L1 positive, right? Yeah. Didn't get neoadjuvant therapy and come to you, can get whatever drug you want to throw at them. What do you give?
So I think this is difficult.
That's why I asked.
And I don't think Alison's wrong.
What would you do? Quit dancing around the answer. What would
you do?
I'm going to keep going if I may. The PD-L1 OS signal for the PD-L1 positive patients with Nevo, the OS signal was in the 0.55, I think, something along those lines. And that did look attractive to me. And I think immune therapy is probably easier to give. Until I saw Matt Gowski's presentation a month ago or whenever it was, I was giving them all chemotherapy. I actually, without seeing the OS signal of Nevo, I really wasn't giving very much adjuvant Nevo, even for PD-L1 positive patients. And in fact, you know, there are other trials and bits and pieces that we can do, but I think we should put those to one side. I think my mind was changed a little bit by that. And I think that presentation with that survival signal and the PD-L1 positives, I'm probably looking at patients and saying, you know, I think immune therapy might be better a bit earlier.
You're going to do PD-L1 staining on upper tracts and decide that way.
We're doing PD-L1 staining.
Right, but that's what I'm asking. So for all your upper tract, if they're PD-L1 positive, they get Nevo. If they're negative, they get chemo.
I think that's probably how I would do this. And I think the last bit to that is that neither of those trials are statistically significant for OS. So you can dance around the topic and you can come to a position, but you know, because neither have significant OS from a statistical perspective, you can argue it both ways. And of course, the PD-L1 subset, I never liked that. I don't like the PD-L1 biomarker. So I hate the answer I've given. I hope ctDNA will change it. And I hate that answer.
Because... I'm glad you said it.
Yeah. So can I have a right to reply?
Yes, of course. If you win paper of the month, you can pretty much do what you want, to be honest.
That's excellent. So I will sing my reply now. If you look at the PD-L1 positive patients and you look at the hazard ratio for DFS of that, it's 0.52 and Pouts was 0.55. You're really going to quibble over 0.03 on that. And as you said, they both don't meet the OS endpoint. The other thing is, if you're going to do that, what do you think about Ambassador then? Because that's negative for UTUC as well.
Let me come back to that if I may. So that is a good question. So I think the issue with those OS signals is, I think the PAL OS signal is in the 0.75, 0.78, that kind of ballpark. I think that the OS signal for the PD-L1 positive cohort of 274, which included upper tract disease, and I completely agree the subset's really complicated, I think that number is a bit lower. I think it's in the 0.5, late 0.5. So I'm kind of attracted to that number, number one. Number two, I think the Ambassador study's got two big problems. I think it's a brilliant study, number one. It's investigator-initiated. I wanted to be involved. I wanted the URTC to take part. We weren't able to do it. So it's very easy to, you know, to be critical from the sidelines. But there are two things. Number one is they used a different biomarker. And I think the CPS PD-L1 biomarker has not performed well. It didn't perform in Keynote 361. And so that the biomarker positive population, that seemed even the hazard ratio was worse than the biomarker than the biomarker positives and the negatives, which was unexpected. Actually, it's not that unexpected. We saw a similar thing in Keynote 361. And then the OS signal, I think, in Ambassador 250 is, Ambassador, not Ambassador 250, that's a different study. In Ambassador, the OS signal, I think there's a lot of censoring on that curve. And one of the problems with investigator-initiated trials, I think, is the monitoring and the amount of follow-up that we can perform is sometimes a bit compromised. I've seen the same in studies that we've done. And so I think that OS signal is more complicated because the PFS signal, the two studies are almost identical. And then one, the Ambassador study, a whole lot of censoring. Now, yeah. Alison, it does create some uncertainty. And again, I think your point is well made, Tom. It's not statistically significant. Number two, it's a subset. And number three, other trials in the same area, atezolizumab and pembrolizumab, don't look great. Are you not, is one swallow making a summer for me? And the answer is maybe it is a little bit, and maybe I still should be a bit conservative. And maybe my mind will change in the future.
Tom gives the longest answers on record, Alison, in case you haven't.
I know. I was just wondering when he was going to pause to breathe.
Yeah, you're probably.
I've been wondering that for 3 years.
You're probably making podcasts, a sandwich or doing something else.
I think we should wrap this up, Alison.
Anybody
who challenges Tom and calls him darling in the same podcast is always welcome on this show. So
you're very welcome.
Congrats on the paper. Congrats on the data. I think it's a fascinating discussion, and I've texted Tom from clinic sort of asking the same thing before these data came out. So more to come, but thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a delight. Thank you.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye now.